This is the AI Health Podcast, where we explore the ways in which AI will transform healthcare, biotech, and medicine through conversations with entrepreneurs, investors, and scientists.
Hey, I'm your co-host Pranav Rajpurkar.
And I'm Adrielle Saporta.
And you're listening to the AI Health Podcast.
Today, we're going to talk about AI-powered cardiac monitoring with Mike Coyle, the CEO of iRhythm, and Mark Day, the Executive Vice President of Research and Development at iRhythm. So between our two guests, we'll get a chance to talk about iRhythm's technology and business today.
A lot of doctors I speak with are familiar with iRhythm's Zio service. Since receiving FDA clearance in 2009, iRhythm has provided its Zio service to over 2 million patients.
Wow. And that's a lot of data, right?
Yeah. They've collected over 500 million hours of curated heartbeat data, creating what is likely the world's largest repo of ambulatory ECG patient data.
That's amazing. I thought that as a background to the interview today, we could spend some time talking about what arrhythmias are and what ambulatory ECGs are.
Let's do it. Do you want to kick us off with arrhythmias?
Yes. Okay. So an arrhythmia refers to irregular beating of the heart. So it's a set of conditions in which the electrical impulses that coordinate heartbeats just aren't happening properly. And when that happens, it's causing the heart to beat either too quickly or too slowly or just irregularly. And so an example is atrial fibrillation, or AFib, in which the upper chambers of the heart beat irregularly, and so blood doesn't flow properly to the lower chambers of the heart. The American Heart Association estimates that AFib affects as many as 6 million patients in the United States and 33.5 million patients worldwide.
And that's a real problem because individuals with AFib are five times more likely to suffer a stroke. The National Stroke Association estimates that up to 80% of strokes suffered by people with AFib are preventable with early detection and proper treatment.
Okay, so now that we know the detection of arrhythmias like AFib is important, shall we describe how it's detected?
Yeah, so to diagnose arrhythmias, doctors use the ECG test. An ECG shows the heart's electrical activity over time. And during this test, the patient lies on a bed, several electrodes are attached to the skin and hooked to a machine that traces the heart activity for the next few minutes. The doctor looks through the ECG and checks for the presence of these arrhythmias. But a two-minute ECG is often not enough to capture all or sometimes any of the arrhythmias a patient has. In this case, the doctor may determine that patients require monitoring for a longer period of time to generate a diagnosis. And in this case, the doctor would prescribe an ambulatory cardiac monitoring device, such as a Holter monitor.
And by ambulatory cardiac monitoring, you mean the ability to walk around with a cardiac monitor rather than needing to be in bed.
Exactly.
So the trouble here historically has been that there have been shortcomings with traditional ambulatory cardiac monitoring tools, such as Holter monitors, that are used by physicians for diagnosing patients with suspected arrhythmias. So for example, they can be pretty cumbersome. And so patients often remove them when sleeping or showering or exercising. And if you remove them, then that means that these monitors can't capture what could be critical data.
Yeah, and in turn, these shortcomings can contribute to incomplete diagnoses and repeat testing, which in turn result in suboptimal patient care and often higher cost to the healthcare system. But I guess for these monitors, their hearts are in the right place.
Oh my God. But I'm okay. So let's chat about what the Zio service is. So the Zio service consists of a wire-free, patch-based, wearable biosensor, which sticks to the patient's chest. So the patient wears a Zio monitor for up to 14 consecutive days. And during this time, the sensor continuously records and stores ECG data from every patient heartbeat. And then the device is returned to iRhythm, and the data is uploaded to the cloud where it's analyzed by an algorithm and quality assessed by a certified cardiac technician. Finally, an easy-to-read Zio report is sent directly to a patient's physician and can be integrated into a patient's electronic health record. And that report is just a curated summary of findings that includes clinically actionable information.
Yeah, the value prop to the providers, such as the physicians, is that they get help diagnosing patients and streamline clinical workflow. The Zio service has been shown to detect more arrhythmias compared to Holter monitoring during their respective wear periods. And the accurate detection and high diagnostic yield here has been found to change the course of treatment from the physicians. And the value prop for the patient here is compliance and convenience by having a wire-free, wearable biosensor that is lightweight and unobtrusive.
And one of the competitive advantages here for iRhythm, in addition to how easy and unobtrusive the patch is for the patient, is the quality and clinical validation of the deep learned algorithms used to detect arrhythmias. And you worked on such an algorithm in collaboration with iRhythm, Pranav, right?
That's right. Between 2017 and 2019, I led a study with my colleague Ani Hanoon in collaboration with iRhythm and cardiologists at Stanford and UCSF, in which we demonstrated that we could develop a deep learning algorithm to detect 12 rhythms with the Zio patch at a level of performance comparable to cardiologists. The algorithm, I believe, wasn't used by iRhythm since FDA clearance in 2019.
That's so, so cool. I want to ask our guests today about the business and tech that iRhythm has been providing to so many patients. And so without further ado, let's chat with our guests. Mike Coyle is the CEO of iRhythm, and Mark Day is the EVP of Research and Development at iRhythm.
Mike and Mark, thank you for being with us today.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Today, we're going to talk about the heart monitor that changed the game. So I'm excited to hear about iRhythm and what you've been up to and where you see this world in which you have these heart monitors that are monitoring patients outside the hospital. So I'll start by asking you about the heart monitor that changed the game. What was the game and how did it change?
Well, perhaps I can begin in the beginning by talking about how we got founded, because that's really pretty critical to the story. And perhaps unlike many startups, we actually are still doing exactly what we started intending to do when the company was founded. The history really begins with the Stanford Biodesign Program, which is innovative in its thinking in the sense that it combines together different disciplines and the expertise you need in a cross-functional kind of brainstorming session, if you will, to look at problems in healthcare and try and solve them. And our founder, Dr. Day Kumar, was an electrophysiologist that really had a good understanding of the ambulatory monitoring space and gaps in it, and really coupled very closely with a business colleague and two engineering colleagues, one on the mechanical and one on the electrical side, to first identify the problem and then second to create the idea of a long-term ambulatory monitoring patch. And if you go back to the first patents that came out of the Stanford Biodesign Program, what you see is the concept and the idea, and the patent specification describes this idea of providing a service to thousands of patients, them wearing this device for a long time and recording in a very patient compliant, very comfortable manner and very high quality manner, the electrical activity of the heart. And there was really no solution that provided that type of capability and that type of diagnostic insight. Previously, we had short-term Holter monitors, which were not terribly patient compliant, typically pretty bulky, typically not well tolerated by patients, and in general, very limited in terms of duration, you know, typically 24 or 48 hours. And then on the other side, you had episodic monitoring paradigms of, you know, patients clicking buttons or capturing snippets of ECG along the way. And at the very end of the paradigm, you had very valuable but yet costly and invasive technologies like implantable loop recorders. That was the landscape. But there was really nothing that met the patient-compliant, long-term, continuous monitoring idea. And that's really what the Stanford folks came up with. If you go back to the original patents and original ideas, it looked very much like a hockey puck. So it wouldn't have adhered very well, but that's where it transferred into the iRhythm and the work we all did to transfer that concept into a reality.
I want to get more into the technology because it's fascinating. And you mentioned this coming out of the biodesign program, and I've seen the biodesign textbook, the 600-page monster that it is. It has this idea of a three-stage innovation process of identify, invent, and implement, and that formula for innovation. I'm curious, when you're thinking of building a hardware company, because hardware is a component of what iRhythm is doing, was the idea always to look out in the long term and think, this is going to take us X number of years to get approval, that's when we're going to start generating revenue? Or was there an idea of being able to do something in the meantime as well?
Well, as a carefully regulated business in healthcare, you have to take a very planful approach to development. So it's very much more the former, in the sense of knowing that we had to go through a thoughtfully managed process of iteration, creation, verification, validation, and then market introduction and performance improvement. That being said, it was still a creative process, and it's taken us now two generations to really get to a very stable and scalable platform. Much like many technologies that are innovative and new, when you first introduce it, you learn a tremendous amount. And the first generation of patch that we introduced in 2010 was highly capable and was really still the backbone of a lot of clinical evidence that we have now. But we learned tremendous amounts from commercializing that. And all that went into our second generation, and that creation process of experience, insight, driving development and improvement is really the backbone of what we do. And we're continuing to raise that bar.
Before we move on, I'd love to just paint a picture for our listeners of what the device actually looks like. So it's a patch and you're wearing it. Is the idea that it's like a Band-Aid, or can you maybe just paint the picture for us?
Yeah, the easiest way to explain it is it does look like a large Band-Aid in the sense that it has two adhesive wings. The adhesive is a little bit stronger than a Band-Aid. It's meant to adhere for 14 days continuously. And there's a housing in the middle that couples all the electronics. So in a sense, the adhesive wings are not just adhesive. They encompass a hydrogel electrode that provides very good and comfortable to the patient and very high quality ECG collection. That information is continuously provided into the central housing through a very careful process and mechanical design, ensuring high quality ECG comes into the patch and is recorded continuously. So there's a lot of technology on the patch. And really the main innovation that we provided is to make sure that that form factor does not require the patient to interact with it during those 14 days. They can, but the battery is sufficient, the adhesive is sufficient, that for the vast majority of patients, they can wear it continuously for that 14 days. And the only thing that they're asked to do, and they don't have to do to make sure that the performance is, or is a, the diagnostic output is effective, but they're asked to press the symptom trigger button on the top, which is a, quite a large target. The whole top of that central housing is essentially a button that they can press to mark a symptom. We will find what's going on in the ECG, but it's much more powerful to the physician and the managing clinician to know that this symptom was correlated to this rhythm. And that correlation happens through those button triggers and diary entries that the patients provide. Because ultimately, most of our monitoring was done for symptomatic reasons.
Got it. And so you can work out with this on, you can shower, you just have it on for 14 days. You don't have to worry about charging it. And then at the end of the 14 days, you bring it in to your physician in person or you mail it in. What's the next step usually?
Yeah, well, we designed a system that is lowest common denominator. And if you think about the median age of our patients is in the early, low 60s years of age, people know where the mailbox is. It's much more convenient for people to drop it in the mail and return it to us that way. So effectively, that's how we operate. And it's very efficient and basically minimizes the burden on the patient and increases compliance that way.
So they send it back to you guys and then you process whatever is in the actual device. And then I'm assuming displayed in some form for the patient and the physician to both be able to access and see.
Correct. Yeah. So it's returned to two intake centers in the United States and one in the United Kingdom that we operate right now. And what that process is a little bit of downloading the data in a traditional sense and uploading it to the cloud, where all the expertise we have in proprietary algorithms, and then to curate the information. And then that goes into a more human-based process to look and basically curate all those algorithm findings on the raw data into an actionable report, which is then provided to physicians through either our website or EHR connection.
Got it. So my very layman's understanding is that there would sort of be maybe two approaches to monitoring a patient's ECG. It would be either real-time monitoring so that you actually know what's happening right away and you can monitor symptoms sort of on a day-to-day basis versus maybe taking a longer term approach, which is what you guys are doing on, you know, maybe a 14-day basis. And can you maybe talk about some of the trade-offs there, why you decided to design a device that worked on maybe a 2-week timeline as opposed to maybe a shorter timeline?
Well, we know from implanted monitors largely that for many arrhythmias, it's a time-based occurrence that we're after. And 48 hours was just generally understood, even before we had the data to prove it, it was generally understood not to be sufficient. And this has played out. We did some surveys early on, even before we started, more talking to physicians who have built up this kind of heuristic knowledge of how arrhythmias work. And they were guessing at what the appropriate time period was when we started. We then combined that with the mechanical and electrical constraints of what it meant to create a patch that wouldn't have to be recharged. And we settled on this 14-day timeframe as something productive. And what we see is the arrhythmia yield curve, which we can now monitor, because we know the first time that we discover an arrhythmia in a given patient, we can average that across all of our patients, which are now approaching 3 million in number. And we can see a very steady curve that is still increasing at 14 days, but the slope has dramatically decreased. And we see most of the creation in terms of the yield increase occur between the 3 to 7, 3 to 10, and then 3 to kind of 10 to 12 range. It starts to asymptote a little bit, but there's still value in going longer. And this is what we are continuing trying to push, and indeed why there's still value in monitoring over increasing the long periods of time.
And just to put a kind of finer point on it and make it a little more real, Holter monitors were the standard by which patients were detected for arrhythmias. And as Mark said, they were typically prescribed for 24 to 48 hours, mostly worn only 24 hours because they were, if you've ever seen one with all the electrodes, they're very uncomfortable and difficult to wear, can't shower, can't exercise with them. When you then looked at what did they detect typically, the fact would be that if you define an accurate diagnosis as either being correctly identify the presence of an arrhythmia, or you have a patient indicate they're symptomatic and confirm that there is no arrhythmia while they are symptomatic, then you get an answer. And if either of those is true, you have a diagnostic yield, right? The diagnostic yield for a 48-hour Holter is about 24%. So that means 3 out of 4 patients basically get an indeterminate result after wearing the Holter monitor. But if you wear a Zio patch for 14 days, the diagnostic yield is generally around 97%.
I want to ask about who the target user of the Zio patch is. You mentioned that early 60s is the median age range that you're going for. Are these people who have experienced some sort of symptoms that are using the patch, or are they anyone who may even be asymptomatic that wants to try this out? What's your target user profile?
So the general user today is a symptomatic patient. So they've either had fainting or they've had palpitations, and there's a desire on the part of the physician to determine if there's an arrhythmic basis or cardiac reason for it. So the vast majority of patients who get our device today are patients who have some sort of symptoms, and we're looking for the presence of an arrhythmia that's linked to those symptoms. But over time, we're going to be increasingly focused on asymptomatic patients, because what we know is the particular rhythm, atrial fibrillation, which is a very common condition, is typically not symptomatic for the patients. In fact, we would estimate that the patient population for asymptomatic detection is probably 2x the symptomatic patient population. And we've done preliminary work with patients who have high risk scores for atrial fibrillation, but aren't feeling the symptoms, and found that a good portion of those patients, with just using clinical markers, if they were to wear a Zio patch, they would, in about 5% of the cases, be identified as a patient with active atrial fibrillation. And if they have that, then you have something you can do about it. You can put them on oral anticoagulation medications and prevent that atrial fibrillation from triggering a stroke, and actually lower their elevated stroke risk there by 80%. So today it's mostly symptomatic, but over time we would expect to see more movement into the asymptomatic patient population.
This seems like a great opportunity, and it seems like a lot of companies have identified this opportunity of continuously tracking either the ECG or the PPG with products now, one of them being the Apple Watch. Samsung's getting into the space. So I'm curious, how do you see iRhythm as being different from any of these other ECG solutions, such as those that go as a watch on the wrist?
Well, the first thing is that the patch itself has now been, you know, validated to actually be a very effective means of identifying arrhythmias. And we have essentially 13 different arrhythmias that are detected in our system by our certified cardiac technologists who get these 20,000 minutes of electrocardiographic data from patients. So that is sort of a confirmed, very accurate, highly sensitive and specific tool to identify arrhythmias. Wearing something on the wrist, obviously, is a new form factor, and it's a new location to be doing detection. And so there's still a lot of work to do yet to validate the ability to actually, you know, accurately and sensitively and specifically detect the presence of arrhythmias. And obviously, atrial fibrillation would be the one that would be the most likely to be the target there. And there would be obvious benefits to that, right? If you could just wear a watch, you could perhaps extend your period of actually doing monitoring from the 14 days we typically do to out 6 months or even a year if you chose to. So it has the benefit of having a lot more data coming in, but probably not the specificity of the waveform that we've historically had to be able to look for arrhythmias. So there's a lot of work to go on here to basically determine, can it be done? What would be the sensitivity and specificity? And then what would be the action to take place? Would you actually confirm it using a highly accurate and sensitive diagnostic tool like Zio? Or is it going to be good enough that you could actually move right to diagnosis and treatment from that detection? And those are things we're going to have to learn.
I would add also just to the description that these are consumer devices, which are very valuable in terms of finding arrhythmias in the broader population. But one of the challenges is just, where does that information go and how is it managed? And in that sense, that's an unmet need. And a lot of where we fit in, which is to provide a curation platform, combinations and connections to physicians, and really a management approach clinically that just differentiates these solutions from consumer versus medical diagnostic.
Can you actually talk more about that? I'd love to get a sense of what your customer acquisition process actually looks like. Is it through physician referrals, or is it actually directly with the customer?
Typically, the customer who we are focused on for generation of patients is, in fact, the cardiologist or electrophysiologist, and in some cases, primary care physician, who is with a patient who's reporting symptoms, you know, syncope or unexplained fainting or palpitations. So our work generally is to work with the electrophysiology community within a hospital to demonstrate the benefits of the service. Then they will basically work with their referral base, right? The cardiologists, as well as the, in certain cases, primary care physicians, to have the system prescribed by those physicians. So that's our primary, you know, sort of target customer.
Can you maybe talk a little bit about what that sales cycle looks like? Are you just knocking on the doors of physicians and sort of pitching them on what the product can do and hoping that they'll actually use it over a Holter monitor or anything else?
Well, there are a couple of aspects. There's the clinical aspect of the sale, and then there's what I'll just term the administrative aspect of the sale. So the clinical aspect of the sale is to demonstrate to typically the head of electrophysiology or clinical cardiology the accuracy and comprehensiveness of the report that we provide, its ability to identify these 13 arrhythmias, its ability to provide a much higher diagnostic yield, and provide actionable information for the physician relative to therapy selection, such as sending them on for medications or, you know, ablation or a pacemaker or what would come from that work. Once you have confidence in the, you know, sort of clinical value of the technology, then it becomes a discussion to integrate into the workflow of the hospital system, which typically involves working with the heads of the service line, if you will, for care, to be able to integrate into their network, right? So that's about training their cardiologists, training their primary care physicians who are seeing these patients about the service itself and how it works, and that it's, in fact, a cost-effective solution for them in the sense that, you know, we talked about that low diagnostic yield for Holter monitors. The result of that, of course, is patients coming in again and again for retesting or you're missing rhythms that could be treated. So we spend a lot of time in the administrative portion of the sale really pointing out the ability to deliver on the triple aim, right? And we call it the quadruple aim, that the patient actually would rather have a Zio for 14 days than wear a Holter for 24 hours. That's 80% of the time, that's what they will tell you. Then the better clinical outcomes, because you actually are identifying on the first time around 97% of the patients with a confirmed diagnosis, as opposed to that 24% diagnosis that we talked about. And then because you can actually do this remotely, you actually fit more conveniently into the workflow. So if they want to apply these technologies in the office, they can do that. But if they want to actually have the patient report their symptoms over the phone on a televisit and then have the service provided to them in home enrollment, we can do that as well, so that they never have to come in to the clinic, and we can provide the diagnosis after they've mailed back the technology. And most of all is the fourth part of the quadruple aim here, is that it actually lowers the overall cost to the healthcare system, because you're avoiding multiple visits, you're avoiding ER hospitalizations because of missed diagnoses, you're getting the patient the right answer the first time, and creating efficient patient flow. So those are the things we emphasize in our selling process.
I want to talk a little more about the tech and understand how AI fits into your workflow at what you're doing at iRhythm. So last we stopped in the patient workflow, the patients were mailing in these patches and they were coming to iRhythm. What happens next?
So the thing you have to realize in continuous monitoring is that an average heart, all of us, beats about 1.5 million times over a 2-week period. And often what we're looking for are very short episodes. Could be as short as 3 seconds of a pause, which is just basically the lack of a heartbeat occurring in 3 seconds, is a clinically meaningful outcome. There are many other outcomes like atrial fibrillation that tend to manifest more chronically and continuously, but finding what is clinically meaningful can be essentially a needle in a haystack type of problem. And really creating technologies and implementing technologies like AI is the most effective way at finding that needle and the most efficient way to do it from both a clinical accuracy and a scalability perspective. The AI technology that we implement essentially takes the device information from the patch, uploads it to the cloud, and runs it through an algorithm that, as Mike mentioned, is capable of diagnosing and discriminating accurately 13 different arrhythmia types. And then that information goes into a human process at the other side, where we essentially curate that into a story. Simply annotating 14 days of data into different arrhythmia categories is valuable. But telling the story around that, how that looks, how the initiations and terminations of rhythms occur, and demonstrating that all in a usable method back to physicians is really critical in terms of actually delivering on the point of our service, which is to guide therapy. We provide a diagnostic output. That diagnostic is interpreted by the physician. They decide the process. So AI is really a tool that we use to improve the clinical value of our service and ensure that if it's there, which our form factor helps encourage, that we can find it and report on it effectively so that the patients can get the care they need.
It's a really important thing to keep in mind that it isn't that we apply AI to this 14 days worth of waveforms and it spits out an answer. What it does is use the deep learned algorithms to identify suspect areas within the electrocardiogram that a highly skilled technician can then look at and be informed by the algorithm as to where there is something that doesn't look right. So it's a very interactive process. And in fact, the ability to actually move the analysis to the right level of trained technician because of the complexity of the arrhythmia that's been identified is part of the value of the AI activities. But it's always a human being looking at every record and ultimately determining what the diagnosis is.
I want to ask more about the algorithm. How do you think about the development and validation of algorithms to do this?
Well, it helps tremendously that through the experience that we've had of operating this business over 10 years and the cloud-based implementation of the service, that we've been able to store the curated outcome of every recording we've developed over time. And we use that for service improvement reasons. And that was really the basis of how we got started with the AI work, which was to go back into our database to locate records that had certain indications and certain occurrences of arrhythmias, to confirm that was absolutely accurate, and in a lot of ways, ensure that the annotations were extremely accurate. For example, for AI, to make sure that it was a really effective input to that, we had to make sure that the onsets and offsets of rhythms were extremely precise, perhaps more precise than was required commercially. A physician can look in the ECG trace and understand, okay, this is a transition, they can interpret it. But for AI, it really needs to know the exact, you know, plus minus 10 milliseconds where something transitioned to ensure the accuracy of the process. And essentially, the quality of the input to that AI process is very much indicative of the output. So that was a little bit of the learning that we had to have, was both the magnitude and the quality of the data that was required to make sure that our AI algorithms were really effective. The outcome has been something that has been demonstrated in Nature Medicine as being equivalent, generally, to what a cardiologist is able to do. The benefit of AI, of course, is that it can perform that level across all 1.5 million heartbeats that we collect and really provide the output that then makes the cardiologist or the physician interpreting it much more efficient in their ability to interpret and then act on the outcome of the diagnostic report.
I remember when we were working on the Nature Medicine study that one of the cool things about the data set was that it was two orders of magnitude larger than anything else that was out there, and that enables the development of these deep learning algorithms. I'm curious to talk about the human side of this. So there's this algorithm spitting out the segments of the ECG that should be reviewed. What happens then? How is that compiled into a story?
So we've had to build proprietary technology that essentially allowed the human process that Mike was talking about, that curation process with appropriately leveled clinical experts, to effectively interpret and manage and review the information that's coming from first the patch and then annotated via the algorithm and into a tool that allows them to quickly look at things like maximum heart rates, minimum heart rates, which tend to be both clinically actionable areas as well as areas that could collect potentially noise. There are many reasons why you can create a signal that has a high heart rate. And some of them are clinical, and some of them are you brushed your teeth at night with a manual toothbrush with your left hand, for example. So we have to create algorithms that can be sensitive enough to detect all those things, and ideally specific enough that we don't overburden the clinical and the human process, but rather be efficient through that. And we'll always want to bias the algorithm towards being sensitive, because if we don't find it through the algorithm, it's very unlikely that the human process can find it unless it's associated with a maximum or minimum heart rate. So it's really the algorithm's job is to be sensitive, the clinical process is to be specific, and the combination of the two is to provide a very sensitive and specific output in the diagnostic report.
That's a great instance of collaboration between humans and AI that a lot of people talk about, but iRhythm is really implemented well in this high sensitivity, high specificity chain that you've built. One other aspect I wanted to talk about on the technology before we move on to the non-technology stuff is one of the key decisions made by iRhythm was to go for a single lead ECG. And just for our listeners, one way I think about that is if you think about the heart's electrical activity, it's in 3D, and imagine taking a photo of it from one angle, and that's the 2D electrocardiogram that you get from a single lead, while in the hospital setting where you have multiple leads, you get multiple views into the electrical activity of the heart. There has been a movement in the field to go to single lead ECGs. Is that something you think will remain in the future of iRhythm and other companies, or do you think there will be a switch to having maybe a couple more leads that are worn as part of a device?
What our business has demonstrated and proven clinically is that while there is always value in having more perspectives available through more leads, the very much more valuable thing is to record continuously in a highly patient compliant manner for a long period of time. It's a little bit the analogy I like to use, which isn't perfect, but you get the gist of it, is would you rather have one camera watching a basketball or a football game for the entire game, or five cameras or 10 cameras, or in this case, maybe three cameras focused on various parts for half or even a quarter of the game? And it kind of tells you a little bit about this trade-off between multiple lead paradigms and the patient burden and therefore compliance that typically come with those. It's just simply not possible with the bounds of current technology to create a multi-lead patch that is as comfortable, as compliant, and can be worn for the duration of time that we are after. Now, the future is full of possibilities, and certainly moving to multiple lead paradigms would be diagnostically more helpful in some edge cases. And then those are meaningful. But the basis of it is to find the rhythm that's there. And that means monitoring long in a patient compliant mode. And for us, that is culminated in a single lead paradigm.
One quick question, the annotators that you mentioned, the humans that are actually looking at the ECG segments, are those all in-house or are you booking hours for working physicians?
These are employees of iRhythm. The largest portion of our staff is in fact people who are involved in this aspect of our business. So it's a lot of people.
So Mark, you run R&D for the company. When I heard that and even just thinking of R&D for iRhythm, I just feel like it must be massive, right? There must be so many different areas that you would be doing research and development for. Can you maybe give us like a high level view? You know, do you have sort of an AI bunch, a hardware bunch? Are you looking mostly at improving the current product and the current patch, or are you looking into different product lines? How do you organize the entire team?
Well, at the highest level, I can describe that it's split into two major functions. There are those that work on the hardware side. That's everything you can touch. It's not just the biosensor. It's also the capabilities we have for building cellular-based technologies that allow our devices to be more connected during wear. That's one variant of service that we provide. They also do a lot of manufacturing tool development, but it's all fundamentally things you can touch. It does include firmware for those things that are more physical in nature. And on the other side is the software side and the system side. That is an equally broad scope of technology that does include data science, of course, which are the team working on AI-based algorithms, more retrospective annotation and collection. But in the future, we see that moving to prediction. But also on the system side, there are people who and team members that are extremely valuable in terms of the work on clinical tooling, on website development, on EHR integration, and on systems that connect and provide information internally for billing systems and customer support systems. There's a whole mobile technology group that builds patient applications and physician applications for mobile phones. And you know, there's all the project management resources that kind of couple in there. That's a little bit deeper on the system side. On the hardware side, it's technologies that encompass everything from adhesives and materials to electrical design to mechanical systems integration, to firmware development on board, and they all have to work together. The other kind of critical thing we have are people focused on usability and really making sure that the solutions we develop are really done in a way that will be very effective for whether it's a physician or a patient audience.
One of the big transitions we've seen for a lot of AI and health companies has been COVID. And I'm curious to understand from you how COVID has or has not affected what you're doing over at iRhythm.
So prior to COVID, this capability to actually do home enrollment of the service was very rarely used. It was not a common way for the system to be applied, right? So most patients would come in, they would report their symptoms to the doctor in the clinic, they would apply the patch in the clinic and send the patient home, and then the patient would wear for 14 days and then mail back, right? Once COVID hit, it was clear that not only did patients not want to come into the hospital, obviously for fear of infection, but the hospital systems wanted to keep people out of the hospitals that were didn't have to be there. So there was a bigger shift just generally to doing remote telemedicine, to have physicians interact with their patients and talk symptoms without necessarily the patient being physically with the physician. The alternatives for being able to do monitoring of a patient almost all involved having to have the patient in the clinic, because if you were going to put a Holter monitor or an event monitor onto the patient, those are in storage in the clinic. Those have to be applied in the clinic. Those have to be returned to the clinic. But our single-use patch technology, and because it's not only a completely integrated patch, but it's simple to apply, lent itself to being able to be mailed to the patient, have them apply it themselves, wear it, and then return the product. So we saw a big spike in the use of sort of home enrollment in those early days, in March, April, May, when COVID was really just starting. And it's come down quite a bit in that there's a much more, bit of willingness to go in. But now we offer that as a pretty clear benefit versus other modalities, that if a hospital system or care system wants to organize themselves around home enrollment, they can do that. And that has become a really important competitive advantage for us. And it was all highlighted because of the COVID situation.
one of the things that our listeners are interested in beyond the technology aspects of AI and healthcare companies is also the business aspects. I'm curious if you could describe iRhythm's revenue model and how that's evolved over time.
Well, it's interesting. We are a service business as opposed to a product business, meaning we don't sell our patches. We provide a service that includes sending the patch to the patient, either via the clinic or at home, having us do the curation that Mark mentioned using our certified clinical technician staff, generating the report, mailing the report into the physician who has written the prescription for the service. And then typically we offer a number of billing models. The predominant one is to actually bill the insurance carrier themselves directly, whether that be Medicare, whether that be a private insurance system. We reach a contractual arrangement with each of the insurers. And when a prescription is written, we fill the prescription and then we can bill to the insurance company. And sometimes there's a copay associated with it from the patient that we have to work with to collect. Other parts are simply with the insurance carrier themselves.
I read that last year in 2020, Medicare generated 27% of the company's total revenue. And that's a very sizable portion of the company's revenue. Can you maybe talk about the close relationship and sort of dependence between healthcare companies in general, not just iRhythm, and rates that are set by Medicare?
Sure. Well, obviously, as you point out, it's not an insignificant part of the business, and the reimbursement rates associated with it get established in any number of ways. Historically, they were established with a temporary pricing code that was done with a local carrier that was established back around 2012. And has been looked at a couple of times since. And basically, that rate is what we've been getting as the service rate for providing the service. Last year, at the end of the year, new codes, permanent codes, were created at the national level by CMS that now are basically permanent codes under which to bill. We are still in the process of having those mature into national codes with national pricing. And so right now, they are national codes, but the pricing is done by the local regional carriers. And so we are in the process of negotiating those rates, and that is an active ongoing process for us.
What does that negotiation look like? Is it you, Mike, flying to go meet with representatives from the CMS and just taking meetings with whoever you can, or is it talking to policymakers?
There are mechanisms that the local MACs use to basically guide how they establish payment for these services. And so conceptually, they have an approach they want to use, and then it's a matter of sharing data with them to basically give them the data they need to be able to make the determinant. And of course, which data apply, how those data inputs are valued is what is discussed and what I would term negotiated.
I want to switch gears a little bit here. So Mike, you took over as CEO fairly recently, I think only a few months ago. And I imagine that coming in as a new CEO of a public company isn't always easy. You have to learn a lot in a short amount of time about the company's business, but also its culture, and develop trust in people who report to you, who maybe are wary of new leadership. Can you maybe talk us through a little bit what that transition felt like and looked like?
Sure. Obviously, one thing is I've spent the better part of 25 years in cardiovascular device technology. So I'm quite familiar with the space in the sense that a lot of my work was really focused on cardiac rhythm. It was more therapeutic devices, right? Pacemakers, implantable defibrillators. So obviously I have a lot of familiarity with electrophysiologists and what they do. And what we do here at iRhythm is the front door to all of that, right? It's the diagnosis that then gets passed on to the patients. And of course, my experience prior to this with St. Jude Medical and most recently with Medtronic also includes not just the US healthcare system, but also international exposure. So those are things that I can bring to the organization. On the other hand, this is a service business, and we're actually providers of care as opposed to the makers and sellers of devices. And so I've had a lot to learn here in terms of just how much of our activity is around the actual treatment of the patient and the management of the patient directly, right? As well as very different mechanisms for reimbursement and business model development. So the process for me has been to earn some credibility from knowing some things about how care is provided and how downstream these diagnoses translate into therapeutic outcomes for patients. So that's helpful, I think, to folks in the organization to get some confidence around my understanding of the patients and the clinical applications. But then I've had to be in sort of heavy duty learn mode here about reimbursement, about the nature of our service offering to be not just the manufacturer, if you will, of the patch itself, but then the curation of the data. And of course, the entire revenue cycle management side of this is very different than what I'm used to from hospitals. So you got to put on your learning hat and be a little humble and, you know, make sure you listen to what people are telling you. So that's been where we are. Maybe, I don't know if Mark has any comments, having been on the other side of the learning here. But
it's really been a pleasure to work with Mike over the last 3 months. And what he mentioned about coming in with the knowledge background has made it so much easier. So as Mike mentioned, the credibility they brought in has already really helped us in a lot of ways. His perspective and knowledge of the therapy side, which is, as he mentioned, the outcome of the business, has given us a lot of valuable perspective on how to position our service and think about what we're innovating next.
What about culturally, though, Mike? You know, we're in COVID times. I don't know if you guys are back in the office yet, but I imagine just when you're a new CEO of a company, getting face-to-face time with people feels critical. I'm kind of curious how you've managed that and how you've garnered excitement or closeness in a COVID setting.
Well, it's funny, when this all started, I'm sure we all had the same feeling of, I'm not going to be face-to-face with people. I'm not going to see people. You know, this is going to be different and difficult. And then, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, right? And so we've all gotten really good at using the Zoom tools and whatnot to create a sense of connectivity. And in many ways, I've found it easier, right? Because on a given day, I can talk to people in manufacturing in one part of the country and people in our intake centers doing the receipt of the patches. And I can talk to people who are curating our arrhythmia data, which I wouldn't be able to do if we were all just using the old face-to-face meetings and, you know, and telephone. So in a lot of ways, it's been helpful to create the connections, but it will be much better when we have the option to do both, right? Where we can continue to take the benefits of what we're doing here on Zoom, but then, you know, really have that personal connection with people as well.
That's great to hear. Mike and Mark, thank you so much for being on the show. I want to end by asking you one question, which is the following. When we speak 5 years from now, what would you say would have been iRhythm's greatest impact on the world?
I can tell you what I envisioned and why I wanted to come here to be part of is really this idea that the use of AI tools applied to biometric data could really make a huge difference in terms of being able to help patients be identified for issues that we can do something about. You know, as I said, I spent my entire career in this space, and understanding how poor the outcomes from Holter monitoring was, and the ability to disrupt it by actually being able to do what Mark described, take, you know, long sets of data and efficiently determine how to analyze them sensitively and specifically through an interaction of a human being with advanced AI. I don't think that applies only to arrhythmia management. So I think there are going to be plenty of opportunities for us to process biometric data to learn other things. And the other thing that, you know, I came to appreciate having grown up on the therapeutic side of the business is that there's plenty we can do for patients who have atrial fibrillation, right? We treat them with oral anticoagulation. We can treat them with ablation. We can take care of the problem that is going to cause them either a stroke or going to cause them to accelerate into heart failure, but we have to know that it's there, right? And so the ability to actually enable much more of this therapy to be appropriately used because of innovation in our diagnostic tools is something that really excites me. And to be able to do that, not just here in the United States, but do that around the world. Those are the things that I think are the mission for iRhythm heading forward.
I think to nicely complement what Mike described there, I would also describe the paradigm where we see healthcare traditionally as being focused on more intermittent and retrospective type of care. In other words, we're dealing with things that have already happened and we're only looking at part of the problem. What we did with respect to ambulatory monitoring was move from this intermittent look at arrhythmias or shorter term look to a more continuous paradigm. And then what we see as the next dimension is building on the retrospective analysis that we provide to more looking at predictive and outcomes. And that's something that we think we're very well positioned to execute on, with the ultimate goal, as Mike mentioned, of really addressing the burden of people with heart disease and making it as efficient and manageable as possible to improve health outcomes for the country and indeed the world.
Mike and Mark, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. We really, really appreciate it.
Thank you for the invitation. You get to hear some interesting stories. I'm jealous.
And that's all, folks. A big thank you to Mike Coyle and Dr. Mark Day for talking to us today. And thank you for listening. We're your hosts, Pranav and Adriel. And until next time, stay safe and stay healthy.
The AI Health Podcast is produced and edited by Oishi Banerjee. Music by Ethan A. Chi. If you like what you just heard, let a friend know. Subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Spotify or connect with us on Twitter at AI Health Podcast.